Pull up a chair. Go on, grab that folding lawn chair right there in the shade of the wing, because the airplane I want to talk about today is parked about 200 feet from where I'm sitting, and every few minutes somebody walks up, stops dead, and just stares. That's the thing about this airplane. It doesn't look like anything else. Two booms, two engines, a little pod for the pilot slung right in the middle like it's floating between them. When one taxis by here on the grass at Oshkosh, the conversation stops. Grown men point. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar. And today, surrounded by the smell of hot oil and cut grass, and about 100,000 people who love airplanes as much as we do, we're going to talk about the Lockheed P-38 Lightning, the fork-tailed devil. Now, before I get rolling, let me tell you today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it, and every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let me take you back. It's 1937. The United States Army Air Corps puts out a request. They want an interceptor, and not a modest one. They wanted an airplane that could climb to 20,000 feet in 6 minutes and hold 360 miles an hour up there. In 1937, that was like asking somebody to build you a spaceship. Nobody had an airplane that could do that. The fighters of the day were fabric and struts and open cockpits, some of them still finding their way out of the biplane age. And over at Lockheed, out in Burbank, California, there was a young engineer, 27 years old. Clarence Johnson. Everybody called him Kelly. Now here's where it gets interesting. Kelly Johnson would go on to become the most legendary aircraft designer this country ever produced. He'd build the U-2 spy plane, he'd build the SR-71 Blackbird, he founded the Lockheed shop they called the Skunk Works, but in 1937 he was just a sharp kid with a slide rule and a problem to solve. And the problem was this. To get the speed and the climb the Army wanted, you needed two engines, one just wouldn't cut it. But a normal twin, with an engine on each wing and a fuselage in the middle, that was a heavy, draggy thing. Kelly looked at it different. He put the pilot and the guns in a little central pod, and he ran two long booms back from the engines and joined them at the tail. Twin booms, and inside those booms he did something clever. He ran the exhaust from the engines back through turbo superchargers. Big turbochargers riding in the booms, using the exhaust gas to jam more air into the engines, so they'd keep making power way up high, where the air is thin and other fighters ran out of breath. Two Allison engines, 12 cylinders each. And here's the detail. The pilots loved, the propellers turned in opposite directions. One clockwise, one counterclockwise. Counter-rotating. You know what that does? If you've flown a single-engine airplane, you know all about torque. You firewall the throttle on takeoff and the airplane wants to twist and yaw on you, and you're standing on the rudder to keep it straight. The Lightning canceled all that out. The two props pulling against each other, the twisting forces just erased each other. Pilots said it was the sweetest thing to fly straight and true of any fighter they got their hands on. They rolled the prototype out, and they called it the XP-38. And on its first big cross-country flight in 1939, they crashed it. Ran it right into a golf course short of the runway at Mitchell Field in New York. Wrecked the airplane completely, but it had just crossed the entire country, and even bent up on a golf course, everybody knew. This thing was fast, faster than anything, so the orders came, and when the war came, the Lightning went to work. Now let me paint you the picture of what it was actually like, because the numbers on a page don't get it. Imagine you're the pilot. You climb up onto the wing, because there's no other way in, and you slide down into that center pod. And the first thing that hits you is that it's quiet. Comparatively, both those Allisons are out on the booms, away from your head, so you don't get that single engine bark right in your lap. It's smooth, it's civilized. You've got a control wheel, not a stick. A yoke, like a bomber, or like the Cessna you learned in. Sit there and you're looking out over that long clean nose, and there's no propeller spinning in front of your face, because both props are off to the sides. So the visibility forward is tremendous, and then there's the punch on most fighters of the war. The guns were out in the wings, and that means they're angled inward to cross at a point a few hundred yards ahead, what they called convergence. You had to be at exactly the right distance for all your bullets to meet the enemy. The Lightning was different. All the guns were in the nose, 450 caliber machine guns and a 20 millimeter cannon, all bunched right there in front of the pilot. That meant they fired straight ahead, parallel. No convergence math. You pointed the nose, you pressed the trigger, and a solid rope of fire went out to the horizon, dead straight out past 1,000 yards. Pilots said flying the Lightning in a gunfight was like aiming the whole airplane, point and shoot. Where it really made its name was the Pacific, out over that ocean. Distance is the enemy. The islands are specks, the water goes on forever, and if your one engine quits, you're swimming. The Lightning had two engines and enormous range, and it could carry drop tanks and reach way, way out. It became the airplane that ruled the skies over New Guinea and the Solomons. And this is where I've got to tell you about a young man from Poplar, Wisconsin. Now that matters to me standing here because Poplar, Wisconsin is right up the road. Northern part of the state, Richard Bong, a farm kid, learned to fly, went into the army, and got himself into a P-38. Richard Bong became the highest scoring American fighter ace of all time. 40 confirmed aerial victories. Every single one of them in the Lightning. They pulled him off the line eventually because he was too valuable to lose, sent him home to sell war bonds, and he did not want to go. He wanted to fly. They gave him the Medal of Honor. General Kenny said Bong wasn't a great deflection shot, wasn't a fancy pilot. What made him deadly was he'd close the range until he was right on top of the enemy before he fired. He'd get so close he couldn't miss, and that nose full of guns, firing straight and true, did the rest. 40 airplanes. A farm kid from Poplar, Wisconsin, the Germans had a name for the Lightning, Der Gabelschwanzteufel, the fork-tailed devil. When you get an enemy who's fighting for his life giving your airplane a nickname, you've built something. And it wasn't just a fighter. This was one of the most versatile airplanes of the whole war. They stripped the guns out of some of them, packed the nose full of cameras, and sent them out alone, unarmed, to fly straight over the enemy and photograph everything. Photo reconnaissance. Those pilots had nothing but speed and altitude to keep them alive. No guns at all, just go up high, go fast, and bring the pictures home. They used Lightnings as bomber escorts, as dive bombers, as pathfinders leading formations of B-17s. They mounted rockets under the wings. There was hardly a job in the sky the Lightning couldn't be talked into doing. Now, let me be honest with you, the way an old pilot ought to be. It wasn't a perfect airplane, nothing is. Early on, in the cold, thin air up high, over Europe especially, they ran into real trouble. When a Lightning went into a steep dive and started really moving, it would get into what they call compressibility. The airflow over that wing would pile up and start acting strange, shockwaves forming, and the controls would go heavy as concrete. The nose would tuck down and the pilot couldn't pull out. They lost men to that before anybody understood it. It was one of the first hard lessons aviation ever learned about flying up near the speed of sound. Lockheed eventually added little dive flaps under the wing to help, but that was a frontier nobody had crossed yet, and the Lightning crossed it the hard way. And those Allison engines, in the cold and the wet of Europe, could be temperamental. It was a demanding airplane to run well, but in the hands of a pilot who knew it, in the Pacific especially, it was magnificent. Here's a story you might have heard, but it's worth telling again with the airplanes right here in front of us. April 1943. American codebreakers had cracked the Japanese naval code, and they learned that Admiral Yamamoto, the man who planned the attack on Pearl Harbor, the most important military figure Japan had, was going to be flying on an inspection tour. They had his schedule down to the minute, but he was way out of range. Hundreds of miles. There was only one airplane in the whole theater that could make that flight. Fly out over open ocean, low, on a long dogleg course, to stay hidden. Time it perfectly to arrive at the exact moment, and have the fuel and the guns to do the job and get home. The P-38 Lightning. They hung big drop tanks on them, and 18 of them went out low over the water, flying by dead reckoning, no landmarks, nothing but a compass and a watch and a heading, over 400 miles. And they arrived right on time and found Yamamoto's airplane exactly where the math said it would be. And that was the end of the man who planned Pearl Harbor. Think about the airmanship in that. No GPS, no radar guiding them, just a heading, a stopwatch, and the discipline to hold both for hours over featureless ocean and arrive at a pinpoint. That's flying, friends. That's real flying. By the end, they built better than 10,000 Lightnings. And then, like so many of them, they mostly disappeared. After the war, the Lightnings that had ruled the Pacific got flown out to boneyards in the desert and sold for scrap. A few cents a pound, that fork-tailed devil that the whole world knew, chopped up for aluminum ingots. Of all those thousands built, only a handful are still airworthy today. You can count the flying Lightnings left in the world on your fingers. Which is why when one shows up here, it stops the show, and that brings me back to where I'm sitting. You have to understand what this place is. Every July, out here on the grass at Whitman Regional Airport in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, the Experimental Aircraft Association, the EAA, throws the biggest gathering of airplanes and airplane people anywhere on Earth, AirVenture. For 1 week, this becomes the busiest airport in the world, and down at one end of the flight line, there's a stretch of ground everybody just calls Warbird Alley. That's where the old fighters live for the week. And when a Lightning comes to Oshkosh, the volunteers rope off a spot, and the people line up. I stood in that line myself. And I want to tell you what it's like, because you cannot get it from a photograph. You walk up to it, and the first thing that gets you is the size. On paper it's a fighter, and you picture something small. But those booms are long, and that wing is wide, and it towers over you. You stand under the wing between the two booms, and you're in this cathedral of polished aluminum. You can see your own reflection in it, and the smell. If it's flown that morning, it's ticking as the metal cools. And there's that warbird perfume coming off it. Hot oil, hydraulic fluid, a little exhaust, 80-year-old aluminum warmed by the sun. If you're a pilot, that smell does something to you. It goes straight past your brain and grabs you somewhere older. And then if the good Lord smiles on you, they fire it up. You feel it before you hear it. Two Allison V-12s, one on each side, and they don't roar exactly. They crackle. They pop and snap on startup, blue flame and blue smoke coughing out of those turbo superchargers, and then they settle into this deep, smooth, syncopated rumble that you feel in your sternum, both engines running just a hair apart, and the sound beats against itself, and it taxis out, and that airplane that ruled an ocean rolls down the same grass where student pilots parked their Cessnas an hour before, and it lifts off, clean, no torque swing, straight as a string, both props biting the air in opposite directions just like Kelly Johnson drew it up when he was 27 years old. Now I get a little grumpy sometimes about where the world's headed. You've heard me. Everything's a screen now, everything's automated, and half the magic's been engineered right out of flying. But then a week like this comes around, and a fork-tailed devil taxis by close enough to touch, and I remember something. The people who keep these airplanes flying are volunteers. They're not doing it for money. There's no money in it. They spend decades and fortunes chasing down parts that haven't been made since Truman was president, machining pieces from scratch, learning skills the factories forgot. They do it so that a farm kid at Oshkosh, standing where I stood, can hear those two Allisons crackle to life and understand in his bones what Richard Bong from Poplar, Wisconsin, heard every morning before he climbed up, on that wing. That's not nostalgia, that's a torch getting passed, and as long as One Lightning still flies, it hasn't gone out. My thanks today to the historians and the warbird restorers who keep the record of the P-38 straight, to the folks at the EAA who put these machines where regular people can walk up and touch them, and to the pilots and mechanics who tell these stories better than I ever could. You can find more of what we do over at RadioHangar.com. Now, if you'll excuse me, I hear an engine turning over down on the alley, and I've got a chair with a good view. This is Tail Dragger. Keep your nose up and your stories alive.